Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the future of the nuclear power industry as a reactor at Japan's Fukushima plant is restarted following last year's tsunami disaster. Christian-Muslim relations under the spotlight in Africa following an increase in attacks on places of worship and international condemnation of the killing of Christians in two Kenyan churches last weekend. Unspeakably vile and deeply worrying. That was how the head of the Holy See Press Office, Father Federico Lombardi, described two attacks on churches in Kenya last weekend, which left at least 17 people dead and 60 injured. As well as expressing his closeness to the victims, he said it's vital to reaffirm and defend the religious liberty of Christians and to oppose irresponsible acts that fuel hatred among different religions.
Of course, the result of what's been going on in Somalia, which for many, many years has been a completely fractured state.
The British government minister for African affairs also condemned the twin grenade attacks on worshippers in Kenya, describing them as completely and totally unacceptable. The parliamentary undersecretary for Africa, Henry Bellingham, was in Rome for a two-day conference on Somalia, which is seeking to promote stability in that country and a decrease in the violence which has spiraled across into neighboring Kenya. The meeting of the International Contact Group on Somalia was being held ahead of a planned transition in Mogadishu in August, expected to include presidential elections, the adoption of a constitution, and the establishment of a more representative parliament. I talked to Minister Bellingham about his hopes for peace in Somalia and about the recent attacks on Christian places of worship.
First of all, I certainly condemn those appalling attacks in northern Kenya, one of which was on a Catholic church, and it really is completely and totally unacceptable, that type of religious ethnic violence. Now, of course, the result of what's been going on in Somalia, which for many, many years has been a completely fractured state. And what the London conference was all about was galvanising and acting as a catalyst to the political process. And I think we're now seeing really, really good progress in terms of what's happening on the ground, and the political side of the situation is now looking much more encouraging. And the conference in Rome this week, the International Contact Group on Somalia conference, is hopefully going to really reinvigorate that political process so that we see an end to the transition in August and we see new political structures.
You're talking about signs of hope. We don't see too many of them, particularly through the media. What kind of signs of hope are you really talking about?
I think there are really five really important signs of hope. I think, first of all, there are now a number of areas in Somalia that have been opened up by the military, by AMISOM. These were areas that were controlled by the Shabab before. First of all, Mogadishu, of course, which a few months back was almost entirely in the hands of the Shabab. There are other parts of the country that have been opened up now. And the most important thing is to make sure that those military victories are then followed up by development, so the peace is won as well. I think the second point I'd mention is that there's a huge amount of interest in the political process in Somalia. The transition comes to an end in August, and we now have a mechanism in place for setting up a new parliament, which will elect a new government. And hopefully that new parliament, that new government, will be more inclusive and more representative of all parts of Somalia. So those areas that have been opened up as a result of the military successes, they will have representation in the parliament and they will have, hopefully, some representation in the new government. So that's very, very encouraging. I think the third thing I'd mention, which is most important, was a great deal of international appetite for putting money into development programmes, large and small. So the Somali people, I think, will have the support of the international community, the Western donors, the Gulf, for example, and many other organisations want to play a constructive part in Somalia's future. I think the fourth point I'd mention, where the UK has played a prominent part, and where indeed the London conference, I think, was very helpful and constructive, was around piracy. Because piracy, not only does it prey on international shipping, but it also, it's been corrupting communities along the coast. And finding a solution to piracy, both at sea and on shore, is very important, and we are making really significant progress on that part of the agenda as well. So without wanting to be ridiculously optimistic, I'm cautiously optimistic about Somalia's future, and I think that that's come about through the efforts of a lot of different countries.
On Minister Bellingham's agenda for next week is the 19th African Union Summit, which opens in the Ethiopian capital on Monday, with a focus on how to boost intra-African trade for the benefit of all people of the continent. The week-long meeting was originally scheduled in Malawi, but the venue was changed to Addis Ababa after Malawi refused to allow entry for Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of genocide in Darfur. I asked Bellingham whether he believed that African countries should be cooperating more closely with the court's bid to bring the Sudanese president to trial.
Yes, I do. After all, most African countries are states' parties, which means they're signatories to the ICC. But there are some countries that are not. There are some countries that resent its involvement. But I think the majority of politicians in Africa and civil society support the work of the ICC. So, of course, it's not helpful when countries decide that they're going to not cooperate with the ICC. But, of course, the AU summit is coming up in Addis, and on the agenda will be, apart from Somalia, will be Sudan, will be the problems in the Sahel. And another theme that the AU have been pushing very hard, which I completely welcome, is the trade agenda in Africa, because it's only through increasing trade, through building prosperity and wealth, that Africa can move on from aid. And, of course, many of the fastest-growing economies in the world at the moment are African economies. So harnessing that growth for the benefit of the people of Africa and encouraging intra-African trade is going to be crucial in reducing poverty.
You talked about the situation there in Sudan. Mm. There are increasing tensions in Khartoum and, indeed, throughout the country. Are you concerned that it may descend into a full-scale civil war there?
I very much hope not, because what we're seeing in Sudan at the moment, we're seeing, I think, a determination by both governments to work with the AU, with the AU high-level implementation panel under former President Becky. There's been a UN resolution, Security Council resolution 2046, to underpin and endorse the AU roadmap. And I think we now have an opportunity to move forward. There's probably another month and a half to go of the period set by the roadmap. But we're urging both sides to negotiate and to find a way forward to resolve the outstanding differences, because what we had last year was a remarkably smooth transition from the referendum to the new independent state of South Sudan. There's a great deal of excitement, a huge amount of goodwill in the international community. A new state was launched, as it were. But every country requires the support of its neighbours. And it would be a tragedy if the two Sudans can't work together on sorting out the oil, in terms of trade, in terms of making sure they've got a secure border. And that does mean negotiated settlements in Abyei, in South Kordofan and Blue Nile, as far as the border is concerned, working out a way forward for the South Sudanese for citizenship issue, because it seems to me completely crazy that you've got South Sudanese being forced out of Sudan. And I'm hopeful that under the wings of the AU, with the roadmap that's in place, we will find a way forward. And certainly at the AU summit next week, this is going to be one of the items that's going to be discussed. And there is a determination, I think, in the AU across Africa to find a way forward.
The political will may be there. The facts on the ground, though, there's been fighting almost consistently along the border areas since the new nation was born a year ago. How much responsibility do you think that the UK in particular, given its history, has to try and support this peace deal? And what else can you do there?
I would just pick you up on that. There hasn't been fighting continually. In fact, to begin with, everything was quite stable. Abyei was reasonably stable, and it was only, in fact, a few months after the launch of independence in the south, that we saw problems starting in Abyei, but have now been more or less, I won't say solved, but you've got an Ethiopian-manned UN force in Abyei, UNISFA, and both North Sudanese forces and the South Sudanese forces have pulled out of Abyei, and that's very encouraging. So if Abyei, if the progress in Abyei can be repeated in South Kordofan and Blue Nile, that I think would be incredibly helpful, because that is the way forward. But there cannot be any solution brought about through military action. If that happens, it'll be stalemate. It'll lead to a huge loss of life. There'll be displaced people. There'll be famine, starvation. It would be a total disaster because already there's lack of humanitarian access into South Kordofan, that there is every evidence that the crops are not being planted. It's the people who are going to suffer most. And so the UK, we do indeed, we are members of the Troika. We were one of the key parties driving the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And in fact, we were the first country that was asked to present credentials to the new government of South Sudan. So we've been very involved. And we have a significant aid programme, around about 80 million sterling. That's over 100 million US dollars in both countries, north and south. So we have an aid program in the north and in the south, and much of that aid is going to be focused on development and long-term projects. Of course, the tragedy is, since the oil has been shut off in the south, since we've had all the recent problems in the south, much of that aid will have to then be diverted to short-term remediation rather than long-term nation-building, which is so important.
You're talking about aid projects there. Of course, the churches, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, already have very long-standing networks across particularly across the region of South Sudan. How much can you tap into these, support the work of these groups, for example?
We certainly can do exactly that. And I'm going to be having meetings on this visit. We've already had a very good meeting with the Sant Egidio community, and they have a huge amount of experience in Africa. And we were talking about the work they're doing in the Sudans. I've got a meeting with His Excellency Archbishop Dominique Mamberti, and we'll again be looking at some of the work that the Vatican are doing throughout Africa, but particularly in the Sudans. I've got a meeting tomorrow with the Sovereign Order of Malta, and I'm going to be meeting their representative who looks after their foreign affairs. And already DFID have been able to work with the Sovereign Order of Malta in South Sudan. They put a significant amount of money into a development program that the Sovereign Order were running. So there's a huge amount of expertise among the major charities, among organizations like, obviously, the Vatican and other organizations, where, you know, DFID were always keen to work with partners in Africa. And certainly some of the expertise that exists in the organizations I've mentioned, particularly remarkable organizations like the Vatican, the work going on there is really quite superb. And I think that it's very important that all the people who want to help Africa actually work and coordinate together.
My thanks there to the British Government Minister for African Affairs, Henry Bellingham. The issue of interfaith relations has always been a major concern for many of the churches in Africa. Yet the recent upsurge of attacks on Christian places of worship has left many leaders appealing for greater international solidarity. To try and find out more about the reason behind this and the role of the churches there, I spoke to Anthony Omani, a theology professor and expert on Christian-Muslim relations at the Jesuit-run Heythrop College in London.
There has been an upsurge of violence, but I'd say but general instability. And in many ways, what we're seeing is a combination of an increasing number of issues. One, I'd say, has been a general militarization of the area, and that's because the West, particularly the US, have an idea that this part of the world has become a place of insecurity. So, you know, the global war on terror, which might have gone into abeyance a little bit in recent times, is still something that has meant that there has been a certain militarization of the area, but also many of the states involved feel that they are increasingly finding it challenging to keep security on its borders. So that's one, I think, very, very important issue. I think also we've seen an escalation of political unrest. If it's in Mali, you've seen the coup in March, which has meant that in the north it's created tensions in the north between the north and the south of the country. There are already existing problems in Nigeria between the north and south about Christian and Muslim issues, questions of resources, but also the function of religion in the public domain. And I think that's led to a general feel of transnational insecurity, which has challenged many states. And I think what one has to be quite careful of is not to see local or regional problems as general ones. But we do see some general trends towards, as I said, militarization, growth of political unrest, which has led to a certain level of insecurity. And in some areas, we've seen local rebellions, particularly among the Tuaregs in some parts of southern Algeria and other parts of the northern Niger or Mali states. And I would say also what we are seeing is that new forms of Islamic thought and practice and militancy in many ways beginning to challenge indigenous or long-term practices amongst the Muslims of the region. And we've seen that a little bit recently around the attacks on the holy sites in Timbuktu, which seem to be directed from a very puritanic Salafist perspective from the more militant Islamic side towards popular Sufi mystical saint worship. So in many ways, what we have seen is a tension around the culture of religious practice, but also the future trajectory of how Islam understands itself in that particular world.
How much are these local, if you like, forms of extremism linked then to a wider network, an Al-Qaeda network, for example?
Well, one has to be careful, I think, because one can see great transnational conspiracies and networks across many parts of the world. But I think the local issues are the ones that feed this. But also we've seen types of Islamic thinking which are gaining currency in the global perspective. And also you're seeing the influence of or the influencing of certain political movements directing themselves towards a more militant brand of Islam. So sometimes it's not direct connections, sometimes it's imitation and trends. And in many ways these types of political groupings do very well when the state starts to lose some of its authority and control over its regions. And what we find is these groups come within a vacuum. Also, there is a general instability due to economic issues, climatical issues, movements of peoples across the region, local wars feeding into another local wars, which becomes a more regional issue. So the general question of instability, I think, encourages more militant, very politically savvy and very well organized groups to move into that vacuum, and hence brings them into conflict and tension with indigenous forms, if you wish, of Islam and Islamic movements. We think of particularly the more mystical Sufi orientated political or religious traditions of West and East Africa. So we've seen that. And in that vacuum, we've seen the more militant groups move in there.
You mentioned the economic and social factors there. West Africa's Sahel region, of course, is also in the grip of a worsening food crisis, isn't it? How much impact does this kind of thing have on the violence there, do you think?
I think hugely. I think if you have economic instability, that means resources are pretty low, and that means those who have access to resources or have finance to get resources, food becomes a political issue between different groups. So yes, it's a significant issue, I think. Also, there's you have these questions of drought and climatical problems which impact upon the local economies. Also, what we've seen is less Western investment in the region, despite the fact that there are huge oil, gas and mineral resources, particularly in places like Algeria. So we've seen a political and economic disinvestment in Africa right across the continent by the West over the last few decades, which I think has worried many. Within that, you start to see, obviously, China, which is has a global economic reach, become more and more involved in this. But also, many of the Arab states are beginning to bring finance and money into these regions. And often there's a question of values. The West has put high priority on good governance and human rights. Other investors don't in the same way. And so what we've seen is not as much a disinvestment of the West, but less investment of the West. Also means they have less leverage over pushing some of the issues that the West feel are important for long term in Africa, of its human rights, of good administration, political democracy. So it's just not regional and local actors. It's also a change in the global external players in much of what's happening in Africa as well.
Within this very global panorama, as you say, so many factors playing into it, what kind of role can the churches play? Because in countries like Nigeria, for example, there is a very good interreligious dialogue going on in parts of the country. Can this have any effect at all, do you think?
Again, it has to be seen very locally. Some churches are very effective and have very good local networks and cross the religious divide and work very well together with many of the, say, the Muslim groups of the region. In other parts, tensions which have come in to destabilize some of the Muslim groups and movements has meant that the church is being pushed to the sidelines in an intra-Muslim disputation around where Islam or the future trajectory of Islam should go within the region. So in many ways, the church can be quite powerless or become an observer on things that are happening within another religious tradition. And I think that's an obvious issue for the church, but also for, in many ways, dialogue between the groups themselves. So churches in Nigeria are very strong, are very well organized, and involve themselves very heavily in engagement. In other parts of the region, they're less able to do that. Dialogue is important not just in terms of religious exchange, but also measuring some of the common issues that they all face. If it's questions of climate, economic insecurity, bad administration, the breakdown of law and order, it's something that concerns all the communities themselves. And in many ways, it's the bread and butter issues which bring communities together and give them a platform to both cooperate, but also to take their relationship forward. But when economic, climatical issues become points of real stress, that means that it becomes a political issue, often between the religious communities themselves.
My thanks there to theology professor Anthony Omani at Heythrop College in London. Nuclear power returned to Japan on Thursday as a reactor in the west of the country became the first to be restarted after last year's devastating tsunami, which inundated the Fukushima plant. The move to restart the reactor came just hours before a parliamentary report on the disaster that blamed the government's relations with the industry for the tragedy. The report said the Fukushima disaster was man-made because it should have been foreseen and avoided. Columban missionary Father Sean McDonough is a leading Catholic voice on environmental issues and has written a book about the future of nuclear energy in the wake of the Fukushima disaster.
Nuclear power in general, there's major problems with it. And the last problem, for example, at Chernobyl in 1986. But many of the defenders of nuclear power said that couldn't happen in a properly designed nuclear power plant that had these extraordinary containers. The reality, what happened, in three of the reactors, the radioactive material came right through the strusses. So two things people will have to take seriously with nuclear power in the future. It will be much more expensive because you're going to have to build now in the context of what happened at Fukushima. And the second is geography and geology. No one expected that a tsunami of the height that it was going to come in something like 45 feet across where the nuclear power plant was and do the damage it did. So in a sense, you're back to the situation. Nuclear power, you know, is very, very dangerous. And all you need is one mistake and you can have catastrophic effects.
But is it possible to build a reactor that is safe, in inverted commas?
Well, they thought the ones at Fukushima were safe.
Exactly.
And they found that they had looked after many aspects of it, but they hadn't looked after the fact that the auxiliary power was coming from generators that were on the ground floor and they were knocked out. But that can happen anywhere. For example, the building of nuclear power plants, they're going to continue in China. Earthquakes there happen very regularly. So again, one earthquake above 9 on the Richter scale and you destroy this the nuclear power plant. It's interesting that in almost all of those countries now, for example, Japan, Korea, the Philippines, that the hierarchy, the bishops have come out against nuclear power. For many years, the Vatican's presence at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna was in favour of nuclear, civilian nuclear power. They were always very opposed to military nuclear power. Of course, many people like myself would say military nuclear power and civilian nuclear power, they're Siamese twins, and they're probably joined together up at the neck or at the shoulder. So it now has changed its position in response to what happened at Fukushima. And here you have, in a sense, the country after the United States where you have more nuclear scientists, better trained people. If this could happen in a sophisticated country like that, what would happen, for example, if you had a nuclear power plant in a place like Nigeria or the Philippines? So I actually also think that the money that people were to put into nuclear power, because it's hugely expensive, if that now is invested in alternative means of energy, like will happen in Germany and Japan itself, I think that is the way forward.
And yet there are those who say these other sources simply cannot meet our energy needs for the future. What's your answer to that?
Partly because the grid that we have is very traditional. For example, the reason for nuclear power plants is because, as you say, it can deliver very quickly if you have a problem, for example, at the end of the day when everyone goes home and turns on the washing machine and the air conditioner. But there are now new processes of delivering energy. And so in many places, the companies say, we will be happy, but we will be designing our system that you will cut down on your air condition for 2 hours at that particular period of time. So the delivery systems will be quite different. And as I look down the road, in many situations, places where people live with photovoltaic, you will be developing maybe 20 or 30% of the energy that you're using in your house. So in a sense, you're not going to have the same need for this big, huge distribution network. Look at it from the point of view of communications. 40 years ago, telephones were linked. You had pylons going right across the world. Now, look at the revolution that the mobile phone brought. And that kind of revolution is coming into the delivery of energy itself. And that's why I don't think we'll have the need for these huge capacity operations that nuclear power is.
As you say, the Japanese bishops, obviously, but also countries like Korea and the Philippines have been quite outspoken in their opposition to nuclear power. Would you like to see the church having a stronger voice in this?
Well, I would, particularly now in the context of what happened at Fukushima and the danger that could happen anywhere else on the planet. And as I say, if you put money into nuclear power, like in Britain, you will not put money into the alternatives. And they need huge R&D to develop them in such a way that I say you've smaller power grids and much more of your power has been generated around areas like your home.
My thanks there to Columban Father Sean McDonough. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.